What they were actually doing was picking up signals from satellites that had been designed to follow crafts by reference to their electromagnetic signature. This work originally began at a time when the Reagan administration had provided a huge budget for the Strategic Defense Initiative, more popularly known as Star Wars. At this particular time period, which I recall to be September 25, 1989, I was told to sign out the transmitter again and take it home. If anything were to go wrong, I was told the equipment was covered by the company's insurance policy. At 9 o'clock that same evening, I got a call telling me to take the transmitter to the south end of the William Floyd Parkway at 10 o'clock. People would be waiting for me at the end of the parkway and would give me further instructions. At around 9:30, two assistants from work showed up and said they were supposed to accompany me out to the parkway. We all hopped in my van and took off. Upon arriving at our destination, we found a police barricade. I drove up and said that I had some equipment from BJM and was told to report there. The police said they were expecting me. They told me to go down to the left and check in with the guys at the end of the parking lot. I did so and saw that some of them wore army-type military fatigues. Others were in plain clothes or business suits. I was then introduced to a man who told me to put the unit on the back of a jeep. My associates and I then got in the jeep and were driven down the sand dunes to Smith Point, located within Smith Point Park. When the jeep stopped, we were shown a table that had already been set up for us. To the left of the table and towards the water was a big van with a spinning radar antenna on it. To the right of the table was a big dish with a huge thing in the middle of it that looked like a refrigerator. Normally, this is where the antenna structure would be placed. Towards the water and just ahead of us was a 400 Hz generator which was turned on and humming away. As I put the transmitter on the table, one of the guys waiting for us pointed out the modulation, power, and RF cables. He said to hook it up and we did. After that, he told us to make sure that everything was working. I then checked out all the stages and everything was operational. Then, he picked up a walkie-talkie and called into someone. Next, someone else looked out the back of the nearby van and said, "Turn it on. We're ready for a test." When I turned on the transmitter, a sort of bluish glow came out of the center of the big dish. It was coming out of the big object that looked like a refrigerator. We could all see a little bit of blue glow reflecting out from the dish and headed towards the sky. Then the man who had called for the test yelled that everything was okay. We were told to stand by and wait. I believe this testing occurred at approximately 10:30 in the evening. Then, at about 11 o'clock or 11:15, we heard helicopters in the distance. They were headed towards Mauritius Bay from the north. Suddenly, the helicopters began to circle around a point in the sky. A couple of big lights could be seen within the area of sky that the helicopters were circling. The lights, along with the pursuing helicopters, moved south over Mauritius Bay. As it came directly over our heads, the crew next to me turned on very powerful lights and we saw a huge wedge-shaped UFO. It was triangular and appeared to be at least 300 feet across. It continued to move south until it reached the shore. Then, it made a U-turn and headed back north. By the time it arrived over the water of Mauritius Bay, the equipment around me began to hum and buzz. The next thing we saw was the UFO fluttering and wobbling. It made strange whiny noises and then went down. There was a large splash and thud. No sooner had the UFO crash landed than the man in the van yelled out that the operation was finished. A man next to me said to disconnect the transmitter and put it in the jeep. They wanted us to leave the area as soon as possible and told us to hurry up about it. My associates and I packed up the equipment and were soon on our way back home. On the return trip, we were trailed by some sort of agents. One of the agents sat in a car in front of my house the entire night. When my two associates left my house, two other agents followed them on their way out. Later that evening, I tried to phone them but my phone line was dead. I went to a neighbor's house and tried to reach them from there. While my neighbor's phone worked fine, I could not get through to my associates. Someone was apparently tampering with their phone lines. The following day, I went to work and was followed again. I was immediately put through a debriefing procedure and told to forget everything that I saw regarding the UFO incident. By this point, I had already learned how to counter their debriefing procedure. That is why I still remember this incident. The other two employees from the company don't remember anything at all. The entire incident that occurred is now somewhat famous on Long Island and in the UFO community. It is known as the Moriches Bay UFO crash. What happened afterwards at BJM was really the start of me breaking the forget-me-not security system at BJM. That is what they actually called it. This led to my getting laid off. Some people think that firing me may have backfired on BJM because it gave me ample time to research UFOs as well as Montauk, but this is not necessarily the case. Had I continued to work at BJM with a fully conscious memory, I would possibly have found out even more sensitive information. The crash I had witnessed at Moriches Bay was undeniable. I had seen something that was very real. I knew the government was interested in shooting something down, so obviously it wasn't their aircraft. This means that whatever was in the sky was some sort of off-world alien technology. The government must have viewed it as a threat. Also, this pattern of events fit in with what many people in the UFO and defense community have said for years. The Strategic Defense Initiative was not put forth to protect us from the Russians but from alien technology from outer space. President Reagan even spoke about this threat to an assembly at the United Nations. It is all too obvious. Deciding to study this phenomena a little bit more, I got together with many friends including George Dixon, who has extensively studied anthropology and has embraced the UFO phenomena from that perspective. I also consulted John Ford, the founder and president of the Long Island UFO Network. These researchers, along with many others and myself, sought to identify what the Moriches Bay crash actually was. Since then, I've become the science consultant to the Long Island UFO Network and have looked into these matters quite deeply. There have been a lot of other crashes and sightings on Long Island, but I do not have specific information on them. That is the province of other investigators. My own research has centered on the technology of UFOs. That is what they are and how they work. This includes how alternate realities are created and how such realities are moved. This will be covered in the next section of this book. Chapter 5, Technology. When I saw the disc-shaped saucer at Wright-Patterson, I was most impressed by the fact that there were no apparent controls with which to operate the craft or its various facilities. The only obvious answer to this enigma was that the controls were connected to the three chairs, as said earlier, hauntingly similar to the Montauk chair, in the control room, which were surrounded by four video screens. In other words, these types of ships fly literally by thought. The three pilots, I'm not exactly sure how the work is divided up between them, think of what they want the ship to do. A computer then picks up the thoughts of the pilots and drives the devices which actually power the craft. When the military began to research these advanced UFOs, there was considerable trouble in figuring them out. The only technology they could refer to was our own technology. This consists of, in no small part, a flight computer and a control deck. Of course, the control deck can be thought to correspond with the chairs. The flight computer has already been identified with the crystals described previously. After that, our technology consists of communications, engines, control flaps and whatnot. In other words, we have in our aircraft many diversified systems that the flight computer operates. What has been puzzling in the advanced style UFO is that there is only one system that the computer operates and not a myriad of systems. The idea that they had a singular homogeneous system makes perfect sense if you consider what the military has done with flight simulator technology. Pilot simulation training began during World War II with John von Neumann's prototype style computer. It has since been developed to the point today where electrodes can be connected to a trainee's head so that he can project his will into the computer in such a manner that his thoughts literally move the dummy aircraft to the left, right, etc. The electrodes attached to the head serve as a computer mouse. As this type of demonstration has been shown on common television, you can bet your bottom dollar that the state-of-the-art technology is far more developed. Of course, Those familiar with stealth technology will know immediately what I am talking about. The pilots are trained in this manner, which is in fact a virtual reality-like setting. Whether a stealth bomber operates exclusively on a pilot's thoughts is an interesting question, and one I do not know the answer to at this particular time. But, the stealth bomber is sometimes said to be a UFO or to operate just like one. The next point we will consider in examining the technical basis of UFOs is the incredible gyrations and aerobatics these crafts have been seen to do at a distance. For example, a saucer will be flying along at anywhere from 2,000 to 10,000 miles per hour when all of a sudden the craft will make a 90-degree right angle turn or even a U-turn. It is a very well-known law of physics that for every action there is going to be an equal opposite reaction. If a UFO were to make such a sharp turn at high speeds, the principles of acceleration and deceleration would come into play. In other words, the pilots and all creatures and loose objects would be slammed against the opposite wall of the ship. Of course, no pilot could experience this trauma under normal circumstances. Some have theorized that space travelers could be suspended in liquid baths that would cushion them against sudden stops or turns, but this line of thinking is far too complex. The system I saw at Wright-Patterson was a device of simplicity. Even so, it took me a while to figure out how this craft actually worked. Although it employed anti-gravity, it was not an anti-gravity device by itself. Although it transmitted radio waves, it was not a radio transmitter by itself. Instead, it was a combination of these things, and many more, all put together. The big machine in the bottom of the craft with the pods and antenna structures was an electrogravitic space-time reality generator. In other words, the device was equipped for anti-gravity maneuvers and was also able to generate its own realities in space and time. Each of the above two modes of operation have their own particular purposes. When the craft is to glide slowly or hover over a spot, the anti-gravity method of flight is employed. It is during this mode when you see the actual shape of the craft. What they are doing is controlling the distribution of gravitic currents all around the ship. In this mode, they are not going to make sudden turns because they are subject to the law of inertia. When a UFO makes a very fast takeoff, the operators are generating gravitation, but as they progress way beyond the speed of sound, they will move into a mode whereby they will generate their own reality. This is done by creating a reality bubble, not dissimilar to the Solodon field that was generated during the Philadelphia experiment. Once this bubble is made, a craft can move at frightening breakneck speeds. When the UFO goes into impossible flight modes, this is the technology that has been employed. Once they have generated a reality bubble around themselves, they are inside the bubble and everything else is outside. With reference to the bubble itself, they are at rest. Being within the bubble or a still space, their craft can make right-angle turns, U-turns or do whatever aerobatics they want it to do. Of course, the only way they can accomplish this is if the mass of the bubble is created to be zero. If there is zero mass, there will be no inertia. Inertia equals 1/2 mv² where m is mass and v is velocity, 2 is squared, so that it read into shear 1/2 of mass times velocity squared. In this case, it doesn't matter what the velocity is if the mass is zero, even if v is infinity. If a real zero mass reality can be generated, the operators of such a craft can move that reality in any way they please. This principle is how most interstellar saucer flights are accomplished. If the flight isn't going to take forever, the travelers need to go beyond the speed of light. In order to accomplish this feat, the reality generated within the bubble must be designed to be relativistic to our reality. In other words, they will go beyond the speed of light with reference to our reality, but in reference to their own reality, within the bubble, they are not. Traveling at superluminal velocities, superlight travel, ships can travel from one end of the galaxy to the other in maybe a week of our time. They are moving at 1,000,000 times the speed of light by engineering a reality wherein the bubble is traveling at just that speed, with reference to our reality. In their reality, they might be moving at 7c or 9c, where c refers to the speed of light. The next point to address is how the artificial bubble reality is created. Chapter 6, Twisters and Spinners. In order to convey how an artificial reality is created, it is first necessary to familiarize you with a couple of terms you probably haven't heard before, twister and spinner. These are highly technical terms that are the province of higher mathematics. It is, of course, presumptuous in the extreme to assume that most people reading this book were or are math majors. I will therefore reduce these concepts from the realm of pure mathematical equations into the realm of workable concepts that will enable the reader to understand the logical basis upon which an alternate reality can be formed. Therefore, all technical people should understand that my explanation could suffer here from oversimplification. Before we go into the more technical discussion of twisters and spinners, I would first like to bring forward to your consciousness the idea of a tornado. In various parts of the world, these are referred to as twisters and sometimes spinners. While this type of weather phenomenon is not identical to the twisters and spinners we will be discussing, it is related and will serve as an easily graspable example to most people. If you look through ordinary books in the library on the subject of tornadoes, you will find something very interesting. Very strange anomalies have been reported throughout history with regard to this phenomena. After a tornado has whipped through an area, you might find a straw embedded into a pane of glass or a car embedded into a steel wall. There are actual reports and pictures of such on file. Under the laws of physics as taught in universities, there is no explanation for this. In such an instance, you have molecules embedded into other molecules. All of this sounds hauntingly familiar to the reports of sailors being embedded in the bulkheads of the USS Eldridge during the Philadelphia experiment. What all of this means is that within the proximity of a tornado, paranormal phenomena can occur which suggests interdimensional activity. L. Frank Baum's The Wizard of Oz suggests this very possibility when a tornado takes Dorothy to another world. Writers, particularly science fiction writers, often stumble upon the truth when they start exercising their subconscious. I hope that all of the above information will serve as a bridge to understanding the more technical aspects of twisters and spinners which we will now engage. Creating an artificial reality in a flying saucer or in any regard begins with a computer generating what is called a twister. As said previously, this is best conveyed in purely mathematical terms. A twister, like the entire subject of mathematics, is an abstract concept. It is a dimensionless point that travels in the path of a circle. We can say it exists because its path can be charted in equations. The equations are telling us that some point, although not existing in a solid and consistent manner on the coordinates of this dimension, is moving around and around in a circular pattern. Although it is not observable in this dimension, it is most easily understood if you consider it to be adjacent to or in the proximity of this dimension. Although a twister can't be seen, it is a mathematical fact. Those who are mathematically inclined will be interested to know that the concept of a twister comes from a subject called tensor analysis, which is an extension of calculus. A tensor is like a vector that goes in different dimensions, all at once. You can get an idea of how tensor analysis is used if you can imagine a squashed baseball. Tensor analysis would be used to create a formula for the exact shape of the squashed baseball. However, while the baseball is in a three-dimensional world, tensor analysis is not mathematically limited to only three dimensions. Those who want to read more on this subject can consult the books of Roger Penrose. Two of his titles are Two-Spinner Calculus and Relativistic Fields and Spinner and Twister Methods in Space-Time Geometry. Once a twister has been recognized and established to exist, the next step is to tap into the twister. This is done electromagnetically. When an electromagnetic field is generated, one introduces all sorts of wild and wonderful variables into the situation. Of course, this all depends on the exact nature of the electromagnetic field being employed. The electromagnetism creates a sympathy with the twister. Magnetism is a sympathetic reaction that brings it into this dimension and harnesses it to some extent. As the phantom particle now begins to observably rotate within this dimension, it is elongated into what is called a spinner. The first step from a twister to a spinner has been described as the formation of an orbiting electromagnetic wave that forms a torus-like pattern. They start with a twister that is formed into an orbiting electromagnetic wave which looks like a torus. Then, the twister is elongated into a rotating cylinder, also called a spinner. The cylindrical method is the easiest way I know of to get a spinner going. There are many different types of spinners that can be created depending on your imagination and, more importantly, on the technology you have with which to manipulate them. The standard vortex shape you hear so much about in science fiction and ufology is a conical form of spinner. You can also make a spheroid spinner by connecting the two ends of a rotating cylinder. The more imaginative can envision other shapes such as a whipsoid, an elongated spinner with a random path that follows the pattern of a whip, or other complex patterns. At this point, it is very important to mention something with regard to the spheroid shape mentioned above. The physical Earth is a spheroid, if you consider that the physical Earth itself is literally constructed upon a series of energy grids that conform to spirals of energy. One can visualize that the Earth itself was initially created out of a spinner. This line of thinking implies that someone engineered the Earth into reality. Was it God or an alien manipulator? It brings to mind all sorts of intriguing questions which are not the subject of the discussion at hand. As the center of one of these spinners is a void, this concept also conforms to the idea of a hollow Earth. The idea of the Earth having formed as a spinner also gives us an alternative view to the Big Bang theory of the universe. The Big Bang theory says that we all started from one point of explosion at the center of the universe. What I might call the spinner theory suggests that heavenly bodies may have formed as the result of a cosmic reality engineer creating an electromagnetic field that the planet is based upon. The Big Bang theory is correct to the degree it states there is a spiraling out from the center of the known universe, but its primary aim as used by the scientific establishment seems to be to sell us on the idea that we are all physical matter anyway. In other words, it is more propaganda. Of course, good propaganda is based upon as much truth as possible. There are a whole series of programs and patterns that can be programmed into twisters and spinners. Once power is put into them as well, you can generate a spatial warp. Out of that warp, a reality is engineered. This is done through radio transmission. At Montauk, we used a large transmitter along with a delta, T, octahedron-shaped antenna to accomplish this same end. While I have personally experimented with impressing thought forms into the delta, T antenna, I have not made anything solid or physical with it. That would require considerable power. Although radio transmission was definitely used in the UFO I was aboard at Wright-Patterson, I was not able to identify any sort of specific radio transmitter that I was even slightly familiar with. It was stated in the Montauk Project, experiments in time, that the window frequency to the human consciousness is 400 to 450 MHz. What this means is that this particular frequency will carry information or ideas which we term consciousness. It is not open to question that radio and television carry words and ideas. The 450 MHz just happens to be how you get an idea into someone's head. How well this is accomplished and how forceful it is depends on various factors. The idea is that a properly educated and trained consciousness can project to another on this frequency. If the technology, which requires amplification of thoughts as well as a myriad of other factors, of the operators can make their ideas stick, you will have a whole series of circumstances that are consistently present, in other words, a reality. This area is actually an entirely different and very huge subject which is properly labeled reality engineering. To summarize, a twister has no dimension. It is generated from a computer, encoded and then spread into a spinner. This starts out as a rotating cylinder which is in turn shaped into whatever form is desired by the operators. This creates a spatial warp around the specified area targeted. For practical purposes, it can be considered like a vacuum. In keeping with the principle that nature abhors a vacuum, the spatial warp serves as a backdrop for a new reality which is in essence a series of thought forms being transmitted at a frequency of 400, 450 mHz. This gives you a bubble reality. Before we discuss how this bubble reality can interface with other realities, it is appropriate to give a brief history on how the subject of physics developed. Chapter 7, A Review of Physics. Before Isaac Newton came along and began to codify the first phase of what we know as modern physics, the world was a very different place. Alchemy was the order of the day when it came to learning the secrets of the universe. Alchemy dealt with the qualitative as opposed to the quantitative nature of matter. This means that it was broken down into the four elements of earth, air, water and fire. This subject further delved into the sympathies or correspondences between material objects and other forces. In all due respects, this was the study of magic. Common history books on the sciences will sometimes portray alchemy as a subject that was based upon infantile and naive observations, yet paved the way for the investigation that would result in modern science. Almost always, alchemy is portrayed in a ludicrous manner. It will also say that the goal of alchemy was the transmutation of metals into gold. While there is definite truth in the last statement, it is misleading. Alchemy in its highest form was concerned with the transmutation of consciousness. Physical objects were considered a manifestation of consciousness and were not thought of as independent or objective objects in their own right. Of course, if one could change consciousness and was very good at it, one could also change metal into gold. In other words, alchemy is another way of saying metaphysics. Both these words have their own specific connotations, but they are both concerned with the idea of forces that are superior to the common physical world. It was out of this background that modern physics arose. If you look at some of the old alchemical writings, you will discover they were written in code. In other words, a modern historian investigating the subject wouldn't have a clue. The true secrets of alchemy were relegated to the secret societies of the day. Modern science got its first shot in the arm when Isaac Newton discovered and formulated the laws of gravity and motion. These laws are still with us today for the most part, as they are of undeniable practical use. If you study his entire career, you will discover that Newton was a brilliant man and that his work was nothing short of astounding. He claimed to be inspired from a higher source. The major flaw in his work was that he considered objects to be at rest. For practical use, his idea was workable. Newton's laws worked and helped to launch the mechanical age. The next major event in the history of science occurred in 1887 with the famous Michelson-Morley experiment. This experiment was considered a major and astonishing failure, yet it sent shockwaves through the scientific community that are still with us today. Albert Michelson, a physics professor, and Edward Morley, a chemistry professor, sought to prove the existence of a substance called the ether, which was believed to fill all of space and was also thought to serve as the substance along which light waves traveled. Virtually all scientists of the day believed in the concept of the ether. It was a unified field of sorts, although it really couldn't be called such, as there were too many unknowns in the popular physics of that day. The concept of the ether began with the alchemists of old. They conceived of a medium that embraced the entirety of existences. To them, the ether was unlimited and not only served normal space but the subtle and spiritual aspects of existence as well. It was the very fabric of existence itself. When the influence of Newtonian physics began to place the emphasis on strictly physical concerns, the more noble aspects of the ether were lost. As physics developed, the concept of the ether was used to describe the medium through which light and electromagnetic waves traveled. The logic employed was that if sound made waves in the air and that if motion in the water made ripples or waves, then light should consist of waves in a similar medium. Further, if there was such an ether, it was readily assumed that light would be slowed against an ether wind as it traveled. Thus, the ether could be measured and proven to exist. Michelson and Morley set out to prove whether the ether existed by emitting two beams of light from a single light source and measuring the difference it took the two beams to return to the original spot. This was done with mirrors in such a manner as to replicate one beam moving with the orbit of the Earth while the other beam would be going in a counter-orbital direction. The theory at the time was that the Earth in orbit was moving along a wind. The wind of the ether, or momentum. Michelson and Morley discovered to their surprise and dismay that the two beams of light returned to the source in identical time periods. This meant that the ether had no visible signs of evidence. It didn't exist.